From Storyflow, this is your daily audio brief for July 9th. Iris, July 9th. Quick run through 10 health stories. Let's start with the longevity piece. Let's get into it. First, from Sustainable Jungle, acrylic explained that acrylic is a cheap wool, like fiber made from a petroleum-based polymer, so it's essentially plastic. One lab-scale study measured about 730,000 microfibers released from a single wash, which is a clear sign of its shedding problem. The material doesn't biodegrade and there's no practical recycling route, and the manufacturing process can pose health risks for workers. If you already own acrylic pieces, you can cut the shedding by washing them in cold water, using a gentle cycle and catching the fibers with a microfiber filter bag. Swapping to natural fibers, organic cotton, linen, wool, or recycled blends reduces the plastic load in your wardrobe. France just passed a law that adds a small penalty to ultra-cheap clothing, scaling up to 10 euros by 2030. Bans influencer ads for those brands, and forces sites to point shoppers toward repair and reuse. It's a first step toward tackling fast fashion waste, and it aligns with Plastic Free July's push to keep soft plastics out of the waste stream. Plush Beds earned a refreshed rating for its organic latex mattresses and bedding, backed by multiple certifications and a mattress recycling program. I'm also mulling a guide on AI sustainability footprint. Let me know if that would be useful. Next, second from New Atlas, Tiny Kia ED. Sea Camper van is amazingly simple but brilliantly versatile. Camper builders around the world have been having their first cracks at the highly anticipated Kia PV5 electric van. Dutch outfit VanTrek becomes one of the latest, somehow creating an innovative layout that surpasses the American-designed IKEA kit in clean simplicity and versatility. The shop's Lightcamp package quickly transforms the PV5 passenger van into a smart mini-camper with indoor, outdoor kitchen and sleeping space for four people. And it does so with light, fast-removing equipment that makes for easy conversion back to an everyday EMP. Category: camper vans, adventure vehicles, outdoors tags, mini-camper van, camper van, electric camper, modular Kia, outdoors and camping, camping. Up next, third from New Atlas, Blue Origin's ambitious plans to relaunch New Glenn this year. Blue Origin's New Glenn rocket blew up on a test flight in May, and the company is now focused on fixing the damage and getting the vehicle back on the launch pad before the year ends. The explosion was a single event, not part of a pattern, so the risk assessment is based on that one incident and the subsequent engineering review. The team has already taken apart the wreckage, identified a faulty valve that caused the failure, and is redesigning the component with a more robust backup. They're also running a series of ground-based tests to confirm the new hardware holds up under the same pressures the rocket will face in flight. Blue Origin says they expect to complete the hardware fixes and a full system checkout by late summer, with a test launch slated for the fall. If those milestones stay on track, the first operational New Glenn mission could still happen before the calendar flips to 2025. Meanwhile, NASA is keeping an eye on the schedule but isn't pushing the timeline. They'll certify the rocket once the company demonstrates the fixes meet safety standards. So, while the setback was significant, the path forward is clear, and the next launch window looks realistic if the repair work proceeds as planned. And then, fourth from Fize.org, grower risked Tasmanian crop pollination. So, there's this study out of the Tasmanian Institute of Agriculture that's looking at what could happen if varroa might show up in Tasmania. They're worried because varroa has already caused a lot of problems on the mainland, basically decimating some European honeybee colonies. The issue is that managed bee colonies can be monitored and treated, but feral colonies, which are basically just wild bees, can't be controlled. If varroa gets established in Tasmania, it's likely to be a bigger problem for the feral colonies. The researchers are saying that if varroa does become a problem, it could have a big impact on crop pollination in the state. I mean, we're talking about a significant loss of pollinators, which could affect everything from apples to blueberries. The good news is that the researchers are trying to figure out what we can do to prevent it from happening in the first place. One of the things they're looking at is how to monitor for varroa in feral colonies. They're also trying to develop some strategies for controlling the mites if they do show up. It's all pretty new, but the researchers are optimistic that we can head off a major problem if we act now. It's worth noting that varroa isn't just a problem for honeybees, it can also affect other types of bees and even native pollinators. So, this is a pretty big deal, and it's good that the researchers are on top of it. The study's authors are saying that we need to be proactive about preventing varroa from getting established in Tasmania. They're recommending that beekeepers and farmers work together to monitor for the mites and develop some strategies for controlling them. It's a big job, but it's definitely doable if we're all on the same page. Next, fifth from Milk-Fed, things to put inside your journal. Journaling feels less like a task and more like a quiet space you carve out for yourself. It's not about perfect prose, it's about letting thoughts, feelings, and little moments settle on the page, which can be surprisingly grounding and therapeutic. Think of your notebook as a tiny time capsule, something you can return to later, seeing the same day through fresh eyes. If you want to make those pages feel alive, tuck in tangible bits, cinema or concert tickets, pressed flowers, a favorite receipt, a Polaroid strip, a handwritten note, or even a dried tea bag. Small textures, ribbons, fabric swatches, wax seals add charm, while doodles or song lyrics capture the mood of a moment. These fragments turn a simple journal into a curated collection of the everyday you'll want to revisit. Up next, sixth from Milk-Fed, my favorite classic literature books. I'm glad you asked. This piece is really a love letter to the books that have shaped the author's sense of the world. It starts by saying that classic literature feels like a lifeline, not just because of the stories, but because those stories teach us how to feel, to sit with the big questions that science alone can't answer. The writer reflects on a past moment when a professor tried to push them into English as an easier path, only to have that expectation backfire and lead to a double major in both the humanities and the sciences. From there, the article argues that the humanities aren't a consolation prize, they're essential to understanding human nature. The author points out that novels like Dostoevsky's *The Brothers Karamazov*, Baldwin's asterisk, Devani's room asterisk, and Tolstoy's asterisk, Anna Karenina asterisk, each hold up mirrors to our own struggles with faith, identity, love, and morality. The list then moves into the Gothic and horror tradition. Shelley's asterisk, Frankenstein asterisk, Stoker's asterisk, Dracula asterisk, Stevenson's asterisk, Jekyll and Hyde asterisk, and a handful of lesser known but powerful works, such as asterisk, Carmilla asterisk, and asterisk, The Monk asterisk, showing how those stories probe the darkness inside us. The piece also highlights more modern, psychologically driven novels. Henry James's asterisk, The Turn of the Screw asterisk, Shirley Jackson's asterisk, We Have Always Lived in the Castle asterisk, and asterisk, The Haunting of Hill House asterisk, and Toni Morrison's asterisk, The Bluest Eye asterisk. Each is presented as a way to confront isolation, trauma, and the ways society shapes our self-image. Finally, the author wraps up with a few quieter, introspective works, asterisk, Villette asterisk, asterisk, Brides Had Revisited asterisk, that linger in the mind long after the last page, especially in the stillness of winter. In short, the article invites anyone who's never tried a classic to start now, and reminds longtime readers why these books still matter. They ask us to slow down, think deeply, and feel a little less alone in the vast complexity of existence. And then, 7th from Milkfed, how to find interesting articles in a sea of clickbait. I've been thinking about how to cut through the clickbait tide and land on pieces that actually stretch your mind. The core idea is to split your approach into two habits, curating a handful of sources you trust, and doing purposeful searches when a spark of curiosity hits. Curated sources, think long, form outlets like The New Yorker, London Review of Books, Aeon, and niche newsletters from those places, deliver depth without you having to hunt. Adding a few independent writers on Substack or Medium can fill the gaps with fresh, original essays that don't fit mainstream molds. When a topic catches your eye, treat it like a mini-research project. Start with academic databases such as JACE, Thor, or Project Muse, which host peer-reviewed articles that go beyond surface-level commentary. Google Scholar works the same way, and a quick PDF tag alongside your keywords often pulls free university PDFs, lecture notes, or unpublished manuscripts you'd otherwise miss. Those tools let you dig into the real scholarship behind a subject. The next step is to read actively, not just absorb. Jot down a line or two that resonates, chase any citation that looks promising, and let those threads lead you to other writers or older books. Over time, you'll build a personal web of publications, essays, and thinkers that constantly feed each other, turning casual reading into a habit of thoughtful exploration. Finally, give yourself permission to wander. Some of the most rewarding pieces appear when you follow a footnote or click a link you hadn't planned to visit. Staying curious, intentional, and a little bit messy in your searches keeps the internet's endless library from feeling like a wasteland and turns it into a treasure map for ideas you'll love. Next, 8th from Milkfed, can intellectual intimacy replace physical desire? The piece argues that desire can start in the mind before the body, citing N.A.'s Nin's journals and Plato's asterisk symposium asterisk to show how language, thought, and challenge can spark a pull stronger than touch. It contrasts Augustine's view that all longing is a misdirected yearning for the divine. 9th from Milkfed, how to read philosophy without losing your mind. Hello, philosophy is one of those things people say they want to read, and then never do, not because they aren't curious, but because no one ever teaches you how you pick up a book and within two pages, you're drowning in unfamiliar language, abstract concepts, and footnotes that lead you deeper into the abyss. The truth is that philosophy isn't hard because it's inaccessible. It's hard because it's asking you to do something most forms of reading don't. It's asking you to slow down, to sit in uncertainty, to question you. Our most basic assumptions about life, death, time, freedom, selfhood, God, it's not designed to be understood in a single sitting. It's designed to be lived with, to reread, to return to be changed by. So if you want to start reading philosophy, or if you already do and just want to go deeper here, as a guide to help you read with more clarity, confidence, and intention, start with the introduction. Always never skip the introduction in most other genres. It's optional in philosophy. It's essential. A good intro gives you the historical context, the philosophical stakes, the central questio, and the intellectual lineage the author is working within. You'll learn what the philosopher is responding to, why the argument matters, and what terms mean before you get lost in the weeds. Annotate the intro, underline definitions, circle major themes. It's your roadmap. If it's a translated edition, pay attention to the translator's note too. It often clarifies nuances of language that are easy to misuse. The Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Philosophy has its own vocabulary, and you are not supposed to already know what substance dualism means, or why Aristotle cared so much about a being qua being. This is a completely different language, and the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy SEP is your best translator. Every entry is written and reviewed by professional philosophers. It gives you trusted, academic-level overviews of key terms, thinkers, and schools of thought. Then grad students use it read with a question in mind. Philosophy isn't about memorizing arguments. It's about asking better questions. Every book you pick up was written to answer a question, so bring one of your own before reading. Ask yourself, what is this philosopher trying to solve? What problem are you hoping to understand better? If you're reading Camus, maybe it's, how do we live without meaning? If you're reading Beauvoir, can we be free and still love others? If you're reading Kierkegaard, is despair a weakness or a form of truth? Read with a purpose. Let the book provoke you. Argue. Be back, slowed down slower than you think. This is not a novel you are not meant to fly through. Some of the best reading sessions will only take you through a page or two, and that's enough. If one paragraph stops you in your tracks, stay with it. Philosophy is not about finishing, it's about metabolizing. Let the ideas sink and allow confusion. Be suspicious of speed. Annotate like you're arguing with a ghost. Annotation should be active, not decorative. Don't just highlight a sentence and write wow. Treat the book like a conversation. Leave actual thoughts behind. I don't agree with this. At all, is this a contradiction? Why does he assume this is self-evident? Mark key concepts, counter-arguments, surprising turns, write questions to revisit later. Trace how your thinking shifts. Your copy of the book should look like you lived inside its symbols. Help, too, the margin is your workshop. P asterisk equals core argument, equals striking idea, equals confusion or curiosity. Right arrow equals connection to another thinker, equals counterpoint or critique. Keep a commonplace book. Every philosopher kept one. Montaigne, Pascal, even Marcus Aurelius. It's your space to collect quotes, fragments, ideas, and feelings that haunt. To you, it's not about being neat. It's about making a record of the thoughts that stick. Copy down things you don't fully understand yet jot down questions. Use it as a map of your intellectual growth. Reread everything you will not understand it all at once. And that's the point. The first time, you were just trying to survive. The second time, you start to hear the rhythm. The third time, something clicks. Philosophy rewards obsession. Go back to the same sentence in a different mood or a different season of life and watch it undo you in a new way. That's when you know it's real. Read with why. Our body, not just your brain. Read aloud. Walk while listening to an audiobook version. Record yourself trying to explain the argument in your own words. Let it move through you like music. If you're an audio learner, use tools like Voice Dream Reader or Speechify to turn dense PDFs into immersive experiences. If you're a verbal thinker, talk out loud. Let it live in your mouth. Philosophy isn't just intellectual, it's physical, emotional, existential. Read with your whole self. Don't wait to be qualified to read philosophy. You don't need a PhD. 10th from Milkfed, how to find your next book to read. Hello, as someone who speaks about literature frequently on Substack, TikTok, and the other apps, I have been thinking a lot about how easy it is to let social media shape our reading lives without even realizing it. Sometimes the books we add to our lists are not our choices at all. They are reactions to trends, algorithms, and other people's tastes, not in an obvious way, but in the way a title ends up on your TBR just because you've seen it enough times, the way a cover starts to look familiar, the way someone else's excitement makes you feel like maybe you should read it too, and before you know it, your reading list starts to feel less like a reflection of your own curiosity and more like a reaction to whatever is loudest. Reading doesn't have to and shouldn't be reacted. It doesn't have to move at the speed of the feed. Here's a real kind of magic in stepping outside of the algorithm and finding your way back to the books that you are drawn to, the ones you wouldn't have found unless you were paying closer attention. Building a TBR that feels disconnected from trends can feel like remembering how to listen to yours. Elf again, here are some ways to find your next read. Ways that feel slower, more deliberate, and a lot more personal. Notes on finding your next read. Local books, or what's your favorite bookstore. Go there not with a list, not with a trending title in mind, but with nothing but time and a will. Willingness to be surprised. Wander the aisles. Pick up books you've never heard of. Read the first lines. Linger. This is one of the last sacred spaces where you can still discover things slowly, with your hands and eyes instead of a screen. And don't be afraid to talk to the booksellers. They're curators. Ask them what they've been reading lately and tell them what you love, what you can't stand, what kind of mood you're in, and if their rec doesn't hit. Ask someone else. Every bookstore has its cast of characters, each with their own niche obsessions and literary fixations. There's always someone who lives for experimental fiction, someone who cries over family sagas, someone who reads nothing but obscure poetry. In translation, finding your person, the bookseller who gets your taste, is like unlocking a secret door. Once you do, every trip becomes a miniature pilgrimage and a conversatio. And in a new chapter, your favorite authors, this is one of the richest and most overlooked paths to finding books that will gut you in the most beautiful way. Think about your top 5 favorite authors and ask, who did they love? Who shaped their voice, their worldview, their obsess? Ions? Many writers speak openly about their literary influences in interviews, essays, and letters. Sometimes it's a passing mention, other times it's an entire annotated reading list. Dig for those Google authors' name favorite books. Look for old Paris Review interviews. Scan their personal essays for the names they drop. You'll start to notice patterns, recurrences, little literary bloodlines. You might learn that Clarice Lispector swore by Dostoevsky, that Ocean View reads Rilke religiously, that Zadie Smith is obsessed with Nabokov. It becomes a kind of spiritual lineage and a trail of breadcrumbs through the literary forest. The books you find this way often feel intimate, like private inheritances, like you're being handed something sacred passed down quietly from writer to you. Your favorite literary publications, the Paris Review, Lit Hub, the New York Review of Books, etc. There's a gold mine tucked away in the digital archives of these literary publications, not just in the latest features, but in the old interviews, staff reading lists, and forgotten essays from decades past. Scroll through the Paris Review's Art of Fiction series, and you'll find W. writers casually mentioning the obscure Russian novel that changed their lives. Dig into Lit Hub's quieter corners and stumble on personal essays that name drop out of print books you've never heard of. The best part is that none of it is designed to go viral. It isn't about aesthetics or book hauls. It's about literature as a lifelong conversation. These are places where serious readers talk about the books that shape them, not the ones trending for 5 minutes. Spend time in those ecosystems and you'll begin to build a reading life that feels both private and expansive, like you're joining a secret club that doesn't care about followers, just sentences that change someone's life. Up next, and then, that's the read. Small inputs, compounding results. Back tomorrow.